this class and I taught lesson 180. So I want to kind of get right into it and make sure that we make progress here. So you should have in front of you, or you should be online, you can have the notes. Lesson 181, the pre-1611 evidence for the text, the general meeting, and the notes of John Boyce, part 3. Introduction. In lesson 180, we continued our study of the general meeting and the notes of John Boyce by looking at the following points. Number one, I gave a brief history of John Boyce's notes. And second, we talked about Boyce's notes in the general meeting. We looked at how Rule 10 called for a general meeting. Remember, in Bancroft's rules that he set up at the beginning of the project, Rule 10 specifically mentions a general meeting, and it uses those exact words where there would be a final review. Okay, so Rule 10 called for a general meeting. We talked about discrepancies regarding how many translators took part in this, whether it was 6 or 12. We looked at some of those issues. We also considered, was there a series of meetings? Was there a series of different groups of men that met and did different parts of the text at the general meeting? And we noted along with that then that Boyce's notes only covered Romans through Revelation. And so I pointed out to you, as had many of the sources that I was citing, that it was a strange thing that Boyce would take such very specific notes on Romans through Revelation, and yet he has no notes about any other part of the Old Testament or the New Testament. It seemed like a weird thing for him to do if he had been present for the discussions on the Old Testament, the Gospels, and the Book of Acts, that he would have not taken notes on those as well. So that has led some to speculate, and we have to say it is speculation, but some have speculated that maybe there might have been a series of general meetings or different groups of men meeting at a general meeting with 3 in a group or 6 in a group. We just don't know. Okay. And then we also sought to establish translators that we knew were present at the general meeting. And we have John Boyce that we know was present. We have Andrew Downs. Downs is mentioned 97 times in Boyce's notes. We have John Harmer, who we know was there. And then a fourth that I suggested to you last week was William Hutchinson, who was added later on. Okay, so those are the topics that we went through in the last lesson, lesson 180. Today in lesson 181, we want to continue our investigation of Boyce's notes and the general meeting by looking at extra-biblical references that are found in Boyce's notes. And so by extra-biblical, I mean references to writers and resources outside of the biblical text itself. So as Boyce takes notes on the discussions that are happening, he is mentioning secular or extra-biblical writers and their work on language and what they think words mean, etc., having these conversations about how the text should read. Okay, so I want to look specifically, the bulk of our time today is going to be taken up at looking at these extra-biblical folks that are mentioned by Boyce in his notes. Okay, now I'm going to suggest to you at the beginning of this, I don't have anything written in the notes about this, that when we look at this, we really get an interesting picture of how learned the translators actually were in all sorts of categories of awareness of language, philosophy, religion, all sorts of different things. We're going to see sort of a wide ranging spectrum of here as we look at the notes today. So let's get into the main point, which is on halfway through page 1, which is extra-biblical references in Boyce's notes. In the famous preface to the 1611 authorized version titled The Translators to the Reader, Miles Smith identifies some of the extra-biblical sources the translators utilize when doing their work. Quote, this is quoting from the preface. Neither did we think much to consult the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or Dutch. Neither did we disdain to revise that which we had done, and to bring back to the anvil that which we had hammered, but having and using as great as helps as were needful, and fearing no reproach for slowness, nor coveting praise for expedition, we have at length, through the good hands of the Lord upon us, brought the work to pass that you see. So I want to point a few things out there. Notice, does he mention commentators and translators? Chaldean, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, and Latin. Okay? So they're looking at all of that material. They're looking at Spanish, French, Italian, and Dutch. So they're looking at all of the contemporaneous Reformed, I don't want to say that's Reformation era translations of the Bible into other vernacular languages of Europe. They're looking at all of that material. Okay, they talk about how they use as great as helps as were needful, that they did not fear reproach for slowness, they did not covet praise for expedition. So what I want to show you there in that is, are they using anything they thought that could help them do this work? Okay, and is it being judged by scholarly men? Here's a point I want to mention, okay? It is very often and common in conversations related to King James Bible advocacy to downplay the issue of scholarship, okay? And what I want you to see here is, are the King James Bible translators just sitting there with an open mind waiting for God to like teleport information to them? Or are they using all of the available evidence that they have at their disposal to make decisions about how they think the text should read? Okay? And so they're using everything there, and Miles Smith talks about that in the preface. So we're the last bullet point, bottom of page one. John Boyce notes provide a window through which we can view and assess the translator's use of extra-biblical sources. In Manifold Greatness, Moore and Reed comment upon the scope of the extra-biblical resources utilized by the translators as evidenced in Boyce's notes. Quote, "The notes compiled by John Boyce on the work done at the General Meeting in 1610 provide substantial evidence of the works used by the translators and the way they were utilized. Precisely the same sorts of books found at Merton and Bodleian Library and in the libraries of John Reynolds and Miles Smith were used by the revision of committee. Dictionaries and thesauruses of Greek words and phrases were examined for meaning and nuance, including the lexicon of obscure Greek words compiled in the 5th century by the 5th century grammarian, I'm going to say his name wrong, Hesias of Alexandria. Let's go with that. Church fathers, early and late, were scrutinized for their interpretation of the epistles. John Chrysostom, in particular, was appealed to, and were volumes had already been published. Circle that. That sounds awkward to me. I might have.
Where? This says where.
And where volumes had already been published. It was the Eton edition, masterminded by Henry Saville, that was consulted. Theophylact of Orchid, probably messing that name up as well. Theophylact of Orchid was once again consulted, and references made to Theodoret of Cyrus, a 5th century Syrian theologian whose works included commentaries on the epistles. Other authorities from the 9th and 10th centuries in the persons of
Photius,
Patriarch of Constantinople, and Arthas, Archbishop of Caesarea, informed the translators' deliberations. Arthas's work included a commentary on the book of Revelation. So, Moore and Reed are kind of giving you a little bit of a scope. Now, what I have done is I've taken my copy of Boyce's notes. If you look at the next point, so I'm on page 2, all right? As part of my due diligence in preparation for these lessons, I have prepared a list of all the extra-biblical references in Boyce's notes. Now, let me give a couple disclaimers here, though, okay? I do not claim the list is complete or exact, as some of the material is a bit hard to make out sometimes. Some of the names are abbreviations for the names of the full authors, and moreover, Boyce utilized many older spellings, but the following table is a presentation of my findings. So, I did the best I could here. There was a few things where I wasn't sure what exactly, how to count something or what have you. But we have a table here of all of the different references, okay? And what I've done is I've ranked them by order as far as who is appealed to the most. So this goes from the highest number of appeals down to the least number. And you can see, as far as our extra-biblical sources go, that Chris... And I'm going to Mike, how would you say this guy's name?
Chrysostom.
Chrysostom, we'll go with that, okay? He is referenced 14 times. There are 14 references to him in Boyce's notes. Second is Beza, Theodore Beza, the great Reformed theologian of Geneva, Switzerland, and successor to John Calvin. He is mentioned 12 times. Scholia, 6. Plato, 3 times. And then we have a whole bunch that are mentioned twice, okay? Antakalesis, I don't know, okay? Arthas, Kramer, Casaubon. Casaubon is the Frenchman who we already looked at his correspondence with Boyce in a previous lesson. Constantius is Lexicon. Here we have the Hisage Fellow. There's references to the Old Latin, okay? You can see here, if you look at the single occurrences, Aristotle is mentioned. Kramer is mentioned. The Constitution Polyglot is mentioned. Homer is mentioned. The Italian version gets specifically mentioned. Erasmus gets mentioned. And so all of these are the extra-biblical specific folks whose works are specifically referenced by Boyce in his notes on the general meeting. So that means these people, their work was mentioned, brought up, and specifically discussed and noted as they were having their deliberations. And then on to page 3, there's a reference to the Reims New Testament. There's a reference to the LXX or the Septuagint. And, you know, all these other folks who are mentioned, okay? Now, some of these, I know you're not going to know who these are. I'm not even sure I know who some of these guys are that are mentioned in this list, okay? So you can see from the list, spanning the bottom half of page 2 and onto the top of page 3, that there's quite a few different folks who are mentioned here by Boyce in his notes, okay? So, John
Chrysostom,
the Patriarch of Constantinople, 398 through 404, is the most referenced extra-biblical writer, 13 references, by Boyce in the notes, okay? Ward S. Allen comments upon the significance of this in terms of dating Boyce's notes in translating for King James. He says, quote, throughout the Fulman manuscript of the notes are the references to St. John Chrysostom, Patriarch of Constantinople, and one of the fathers of the Greek Church. Some of the references include pagination, some do not. Of those which do include pagination, all save for one refer to the 1610 volume of Sir Henry Saville's edition of St. John Chrysostom's works, in addition to which both John Boyce and Andrew Downs contributed their labors. All of the references to St. John Chrysostom which do not show pagination refer to material printed in volumes which appeared between the years 1611 and 1613. The one reference which has pagination but which does not refer to the 1610 volume occurs in the epistle to Titus, chapter 3, verse 14. Chrysostom in Romans 16, homily page 30, 312. This homily is printed in Henry Saville's 1611 volume, but pagination cited by Boyce's notes is not a reference to that volume. It refers instead to a volume printed in Heidelberg in 1596. This argues 2 points. Boyce made the notes after the printing of Dr. Henry Saville's 1610 volume, but before the printing of the 1611 volume, and a later hand did not insert the pagination of the references to the 1610 edition. Had such an editing occurred, it seems likely that the references to St. John Chrysostom's would have been inserted to fit volumes in Henry Saville's editions. Thus, the pagination offers a reliable witness, and that witness furnishes for the notes for which Fulham copied a terminus a quo, earliest possible date of 1610, and a terminus ad quem, the point at which something ends or finishes, of 1611. The space of 9 months which Walker records for this work is most likely correct. Furthermore, the falling out of these 9 months between 1610 and 1611 makes likely that the company of revisers must, to all intents and purposes, have been solely responsible for the composition of the final version of the authorized version. For this computation leaves almost no time for Bishop Bilson and Dr. Smith's finishing touch. It is important that it is possible that the finishing touch may have been no more than assembling the prefaces. So what he's saying there is sort of a long-winded way of saying these notes to St. John of Chrism that are datable with pagination date to an edition that was published in 1610. So that 1610 edition had to have been of known to Boyce for him to have cited specific page numbers from that, which then dates his notes to at some point in 1610 after that was published. Are you guys following that? Any questions about that? While many of the names in the table, so I'm at the bottom of page 3, while many of the names in the table above are probably unfamiliar to some, there are some well-known historical figures that cannot be overlooked, okay? The names Plato, 3 references. Casaubon, 2 references. Aristotle, 1 reference. Erasmus, 1 reference. And Thucydides indicate the level of scholarly learning that the King James translators were familiar with. Now, Thucydides writes on the history of the Peloponnesian War. It's got nothing to do with the Bible. So the reason they would be citing Thucydides is because of some Greek word that Thucydides used that they wanted to make a note of a specific meaning of that word, okay? So the names, Plato, Aristotle, Erasmus, Thucydides, etc., they indicate the scope of who they were surveying in doing their work from a scholarly point of view. Likewise, with the foreign language translations and linguistic reference works utilized by the translators. The Old Latin version gets 2 mentions. The Complutensian Polyglot gets 1 mention. The Italian version, 1 mention. The Septuagint gets at least 1 reference, and the Reims New Testament gets 1 reference. So the list found within the table above does not include what the various companies may have looked at when doing their company work before the general meeting. So that's important to keep in mind. All that list that I showed you here, this entire list, this is only the things that are specifically mentioned in Boyce's notes. Remember, a whole lot of work had already been done by the time we got to the general meeting. So we don't know who else they might have looked at, what else they might have consulted as they did their work. So if you go to page 4, again, look at the first lines on page 4. The list found within the table above does not include the various companies may have looked at when doing their work before the general meeting. The King James translators truly left no scholarly stone unturned when doing their work. Okay? So everyone who trusts the King James Bible in the 21st century as God's word for English-speaking people, are they trusting to a degree the scholarly work of the King James translators? And were the King James translators doing this at an exceedingly high level, looking at basically anything that was available to them in English, foreign language, dictionaries, lexicons, other translations, anything that they could get their hands on that they thought would help, did they use that material? So, does anybody have any questions about this before we move on? No?
I guess I'm curious as to why they would use some of these extra biblical resources.
They are using them almost exclusively for their word usage choices. Okay. To establish meanings of Greek words. Not because they're necessarily endorsing Platonic philosophy, but because there's a fine point of demarcation in a way a word is used that they are bringing up. Okay? Now, some of the other ones, like the church fathers, they're after sometimes what are their theological interpretations on different things. And Beza, who we're going to talk about quite a bit here in a minute, is important for some other reasons. Okay, but yeah, I mean, that's the best answer I can give you based on if, now I can hand you the notes and you could read them yourself. and see what I'm talking about, but it's almost always a short reference to how a word is being used, or how a certain author used a particular word, and then how that might relate to how they understand that word. That's mostly what they're doing. Now, some of them are theological in nature, as they talk about, you know, the meaning of certain passages. We'll see that, I think, next week in the notes, where they're debating, well, is what Augustine said about this verse correct or not? In one verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I think. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, like verse 11 or something like that, they have this conversation about what's the right way to view this verse. So there's all kinds of different reasons why some of these names might be being mentioned. Okay. Any other questions? All right. So the reference to the Septuagint or LXX in Boyce's notes is interesting to consider. Okay. Scholar Nicholas Hardy has uncovered a copy of the Septuagint annotated in Boyce's own handwriting. So the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Now, it is very debated when this was actually done. Most scholars, if you go to any Christian university, they will say that Jesus and the apostles used the Septuagint when they wrote the New Testament, and that they are quoting from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Let me just be upfront with you about it. I do not subscribe to that view. I cannot understand for the life of me why the Lord Jesus Christ, a Jewish, first century Jewish person, is using a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Okay? Now, at some point the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek. I just question strongly whether that was done before the time of Jesus or after. And I have reasons for that that would take too long for me to get into right here, right now. I think there's a few videos on the church's YouTube page where I talk about this issue specifically, okay? But they do mention the LXX. They mention the Septuagint. The translators do in Boyce's notes, okay? So let's start that over. The reference to the Septuagint or LXX in Boyce's notes is interesting to consider. Scholar Nicholas Hardy has uncovered a copy of the Septuagint annotated in Boyce's own handwriting. So there is a copy of the LXX, the Septuagint, that Boyce's handwritten notes are in. Okay? Jeffrey Allen Miller's essay, "The Earliest Known Draft of the King James Bible, Samuel Ward's Draft of 1 Esdras, and Wisdom 3-4, in Laborers in the Vineyard of the Lord, Scholarship in the Making of the King James Version," touches upon this in two different places. So let's look at the first one from page 221 and 222. He says, quote, "Most famously, two manuscript copies have been discovered of the notes taken at the General Revisory meeting in London by John Boyce, one of Ward's colleagues from the Second Cambridge Company. The notes span Romans to Revelation, and they provide invaluable insight into the kinds of discussions that went on at the general meeting and the rationale for some of the changes changes of translation made there. They do not, though, represent a draft of the King James Bible, but rather Boyce's personal record of part of the general meeting's proceedings. Furthermore, unfortunately, both extant versions of the notes stand only as a copy, at one, in fact, being a copy of a copy, and perhaps the full one of Boyce's original notes themselves, which surely would have been in Boyce's own hand, and which have never been found." So there's nothing new there. We've talked about all that stuff already. "The notes also, of course, belong to an even later stage of the Bible's composition process, the general meeting, than at least two of the drafts already discussed, namely the Bodleian's annotated Gospels and the Lambeth Palace draft of the New Testament epistles." We have talked about all of that stuff at length already in this class. The last item that bears noting here has only recently been identified, and it likewise goes back to Boyce. In this case, even more directly, once more in the Bodleian, there exists a heavily annotated copy of a 1587 Roman Septuagint, a landmark edition of the Greek text, and thanks to the work of Nicholas Hardy, we now know this to have been Boyce's own copy, with the annotations being in Boyce's own hand. Moreover, it appears to have been used by Boyce during his work as a translator, both with the Second Cambridge Company and as a later member of the General Revisory Meeting. Boyce's Septuagint represents a treasure trove to scholars, not just of the King James Bible, but of early modern theological intellectual history as a whole. Again, however, it does not stand as a draft itself of the King James translation, but rather as something, even the most important thing, that Boyce used in the process of his work as a translator on the various portions of the text with which he was involved. So let's stop there. You will remember that Boyce was on the Second Cambridge Committee that did the Apocrypha. The LXX, the Septuagint, is a Greek translation of the Hebrew, which includes apocryphal books. So if John Boyce is working on the apocryphal section and he has a Greek translation of the Hebrew, you would understand that would that be a resource that he would view as important for his work. And so we have it. It's in the Bodleian Library. It is currently being studied right now. There is nothing, to my knowledge, I'm watching for it to be published or something to be released on it. But it has not been published or released yet. But you can understand why that would be an important thing for Boyce to use, given the specific part of the assignment that he was tasked with working on. And then later in the same essay from page 230, Miller says the following quote. To begin with, given the recent identification of Boyce's aforementioned copy of the 1587 Roman Septuagint, heavily annotated in Boyce's hand and seemingly used by him in working on the King James translation, one might have expected this to have been a version of the Septuagint from which Ward himself worked in translating 1st Esdras and Wisdom. The 1587 Roman edition was the first, and through the time of the King James Bible, the only edition of the Septuagint to be based on the manuscript known as Codex Vaticanus. Interesting. Let's continue. In the years when Boyce and Ward would have been working as translators and for decades thereafter, many considered Codex Vaticanus to be the best manuscript witness known to survive to the Septuagint's original Greek, and this accordingly gave the Roman edition of the text a strong claim at being the most authoritative edition of the Septuagint available. It would be, for example, the version of the Septuagint printed in the London Polyglot Bible of 1653 to 1657, at least with respect to 1st Esdras. However, Ward appears not to have used the Roman Septuagint as his primary Greek text. All right, so you got to stop there for a minute. All right, so there are people right now on the internet who are losing their mind. Okay, because I mentioned Codex Vaticanus, and I mentioned a King James Bible translator using a portion of Codex Vaticanus in doing their work. So you have to understand what's going on here. This Roman edition from 1587 of the Septuagint is a printing of only the Old Testament portion of Codex Vaticanus in Greek. It does not include the New Testament. And that is the portion that is the most in dispute. Okay, so let's go to my point, page 5. I shared this with one of the guys that I bounce things off of online, and he agreed with me that there would be some people that are going to really lose their shirt over this, okay? Now, the reference to Codex Vaticanus, or B, is interesting to say the least. It is important to note that all the printed editions of the LXX are based upon Codex Vaticanus or Codex Sinaiticus or some combination thereof. I have at home, I should have brought it, I forgot to do it, I have an LXX at home. It has the Greek in the main body and it has the English in the margin. Okay? Anything that you buy in the store today that will be marketed as the LXX is some combination of Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. They're Old Testament sections that are put out as the LXX. Okay? Let's go on. Furthermore, it was the Old Testament and Apocryphal sections of Codex Vaticanus that could be found within the Rome edition of 1587. So the main takeaway here is it was not the New Testament. It was only what we would identify as the Old Testament and the Apocrypha that were in this 1587 Roman edition of the LXX. Okay? However, the apocryphal books are scattered throughout the same way they would be in a Catholic Bible. Okay? So let me read that again. Furthermore, it was only the Old Testament and apocryphal sections of Codex Vaticanus that could be found within the Rome edition of 1587. Now, I will also say, I have pulled this edition off the internet, this Rome edition, and some of it I can submit to Google Translate and understand some of what is on the cover, and it is what these guys are saying that it is. So, put another way, the New Testament section of the controversial Roman Codex was not in print until the 19th century, okay? So I want to be clear. Boyce's notes are written in a 1587, what's called the Sixtine edition of the LXX, which is basically a printing of the Old Testament portion of Codex Vaticanus. Okay? It is not, however, including the New Testament. This does not mean, however, that Protestant scholars of the late 16th and early 17th centuries were wholly unaware of the Codex's controversial New Testament readings. Okay? In the 1520s and 1530s, via correspondence with his friends Bombastius and Sepulveda, Erasmus had been made aware of some important textual variants, 1 John 5:7 and 365 other readings found within Codex Vaticanus. Erasmus views B, or Codex Vaticanus, as part of a medieval move by the Council of Florence in 1431 through 1499 to conform Greek manuscripts to the Latin Vulgate. Consequently, most of the variant New Testament readings found in B were left out of printed editions of the Textus Receptus. Okay? So, in an ironic twist of fate, the Old Testament and apocryphal sections of Codex Vaticanus have in them in this one edition, the handwritten notes of the King James Bible translator. They were not, however, accepting the New Testament readings of Codex Vaticanus. And at this point, no Protestant scholar had ever really even looked at the New Testament section of Codex Vaticanus. And it wasn't even a big deal yet until later on into the 19th century. Okay? And Erasmus, through his correspondence, was made aware of some of the major textual variants in Codex Vaticanus. So, any questions about that? All right. So let's finish these by talking about the influence of Theodore Beza. So the influence of Theodore Beza, second only to, what's his name? Chrysostom, 14. That's 14 references in Boyce's notes, and second only to Chrysostom in Boyce's notes in terms of references is the Genevan Calvinist scholar and editor of the Greek New Testament, Theodore Beza, with 12 mentions. So if you go back to my table where I added all this up, you'll see that second on the list is who?
Beza.
Okay? Irena Bacchus devotes an entire chapter of her monograph titled The Reformed Roots of the English New Testament the influence of Theodore Beza on the English New Testament to discussing Boyce's use of Beza in his notes. So, Boyce makes 12 explicit references to Beza in his notes. All right? He says, Backus says, quote, Boyce in his notes refers to a wide range of scholarship, classical, patristic, and contemporary. Mostly the scholars in question are referred to by name only, with no mention, of work or page number. The only work to receive precise references, including page numbers, is the first volume of Sir Henry Saville's edition of Chrysostom. This came out in 1610, just before the committee assembled, so would not have been familiar to the revisers. Now, when she says revisers there, she's talking about the committee. The committees, not the guys who are on the Committee of Final Review. In the same way, for examples of the editions of Camerarius, Augustine, or Hesius, which they were using, Beza is probably mentioned more often than any other single scholar, but Boyce does not say which edition of Beza is being used. However, Boyce's reference to 1 Corinthians 10, verse 30, quote, this interpretation rejected by Beza, A.D., that's Anthony Downs, deemed worthy of his advocacy. In 1 Timothy 1, 5, quote, not, however, of the law in general, as Beza has annotated incorrectly in this place. And then again, James 1, 3, for what the difference is, however, between, then he mentions two different Greek words, look in the writings of Beza at Romans 5, 4, show that Beza's annotations as well as his text were being consulted. So what Irina Backus's point is there is they are looking not only at Beza's main body of his Greek text, but are they also looking at the annotations that Beza includes? So, as her title suggests, Backus seeks to prove, the influence that Beza had upon the King James Bible translators, especially, and the English New Testament more generally. Backus goes on to catalog all of the references to Beza found in Boyce's notes and to clarify them into different categories. Top page 6. Quote, of the instances where Beza is specifically referenced by the committee, Romans 5:12, Romans 11:31, Romans 13:1, 1 Corinthians 10:10, 10:17, Ephesians 1:13, 1 Timothy 1:5, Hebrews 4:1, James 1:3, James 2:22, 1 Peter 1:20, and 1 Peter 2:5, five of them, 1 Corinthians 10:17, 1 Timothy 1:5, Hebrews 4:1, James 2:2, Romans 5:12, provide an occasion for either a rejection or criticism of Beza. In five cases, Romans 11:31, 1 Corinthians 10:30, Ephesians 1:13, 1 Peter 1:20, 1 Peter 2:5, Beza's opinion is merely quoted, and in two cases, Romans 13:1 and James 1:3, Boyce approves Beza's translation and explanation respectively. So, let's just stop there. Does Beza get 12 mentions, and does he get mixed commentary in the notes on his renderings and translations, etc., okay, and readings? In the case of the five instances listed above, in three cases, 1 Corinthians 10:17, 1 Timothy 1:5, Hebrews 4:1, the final version of the AV agrees with Boyce against Beza. That means they went with the reading that Boyce records against what Theodore Beza had. So they're deciding against Beza. Moreover, it must be borne in mind that in 1 Corinthians 10:17, no other English version follows Beza's reading, and at 1 Timothy 1:5, the AV simply follows the earlier English reading, thus avoiding commitment on whether the Greek word refers to that particular charge or to a Christian teaching in general. Only in the case of Hebrews 4:1 does the AV agree with the final revision committee against Beza and English versions from Tyndall to Bishop 1602. In two cases, Romans 5:12 and James 2:22, the AV agrees with Beza against Boyce. At Romans 5:12, the AV Beeson reading is in whom is in the margin, even though the final revision committee considered it, quote, difficult and unnecessary. So there they put the Beeson reading in the marginal note. And at James 2:22, the AV reads, seest thou, which Beza, along, although Boyce had suggested that the interrogative should have been written. In these cases where Beza's opinion is simply quoted, the AV is found to follow Beza without exception. Thus, in Romans 11:31, the AV is the only one of the English versions to adopt the Beeson punctuation. At 1 Corinthians 10:30, the Beeson interpretation is adopted in the AV text, but with the backing of the Geneva and Bishop's versions. At Ephesians 1:13, where Boyce suggests that either you have trusted after Beza or ye were appointed by lot, from verse 11 should be supplied, the AV chooses the former. In 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 20, the Beeson translation foreordained is adopted by the AV, though again with the backing of the previous English versions. Example, ordained before, from Tyndall. In 1 Peter chapter 2 verse 5, now look, we could be looking at all these verses and you'd still be like, what are you talking about? Okay, so we're just going to go through this. The point you need to be getting here is this. Is Beza influencing heavily what they're doing?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Let's just go to the last paragraph there. Finally, in the two cases where the Beeson reading is actually commended by the final review committee at Romans 13:1, the AV inserts Beza's translation ordered in the margin. And at James 1:11, the AV is in agreement with most other English versions reading trying. Okay, now, the importance of Beza and his fourth edition of the Greek New Testament from 1598 cannot be overstated. Backus explains why in her monograph, quote, it must be remembered that Beza's New Testament was the latest edition of the New Testament, and so would have been considered the most authoritative. Independent evidence of this is proved by Fulks, a defense of the sincere and true translations of the Holy Scriptures, which deals almost exclusively with Beza's Greek Testament. We can also gather from other sources that Beza was not only extremely popular in late Elizabethan and early Jamesian England, but also enjoyed a considerable eminence. His work would have been known to the final revision committee, and on some occasions, there would have been no need to refer to the author. Added to this is the fact that John Boyce was simply making a record of the committee's proceedings, and so probably had neither the time nor the need for precise references in every single case. As we will see from a detailed examination of Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, and Hebrews, that quite often Boyce's glosses show the influence of Beza without there being a specific reference to the Genevan scholar. Moreover, the AV quite often inserts Beeson readings which are completely unacknowledged by Boyce. Some of these come from the Geneva Bible, others come into the English New Testament with the AV. The exact proportion of these will be estimated by the following inquiry. Okay, now look guys, I hope your eyes are not glazed over here, because what we're talking about is extremely important and technical stuff about this, okay? Du Bois's notes give us a window into what they did and who influenced them and how they did what they did, okay? Beza is front and center at the top of the list as somebody who was influencing what they were doing, okay? And his fourth edition of the Greek New Testament from 1598 was literally the most recent edition of the Greek New Testament that they had available to them. So, as stated in the above quote, Backus conducted a detailed examination of Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, and Hebrews on pages 113 to 160, 47 total pages of her book, The Reformed Roots of the English New Testament, The Influence of Theodore Beza on the English New Testament. While her discussion is both meticulous and fascinating, it is beyond the scope of this class. Okay, so some of you are like, yeah, praise the Lord, I'm glad you're not going to take us through all 47 pages. Now, if you really want to know, and are really into wanting to understand what happened, you need to read the 47 pages, okay? But I'm not going to cover all that here. So what do you need to get from it then? While her discussion is both meticulous and fascinating, it is beyond the scope of this class. Interested parties are encouraged to read Backus's work for themselves to glean these details. We will therefore limit our discussion to some of her conclusory findings and statements. Quote, generally, so this is, after all of this, this is a summary statement, okay? After all 47 pages of collation and etc., generally there seems to be no doubt, so far as the revisers were concerned, Beza's authority completely overshadowed that of any other New Testament scholar of the period. This does not imply that the AV is no more than an English version of Beza's 1598 New Testament. So it does not mean that. In matters of text, especially, the revisers were unwilling to adopt a Beza reading if it did not have authoritative support. In cases where Beza's text was accepted, the more usual reading was frequently, the more unusual reading, is that right? Yeah. Usual or unusual? I need to check that. I think it should say unusual. The more unusual reading was frequently inserted into the margin. That would make sense that a more unusual reading would be put in the margin, not in the main body of the text. Conversely, where a better known reading was adopted, the Beza version was put in as a marginal alternative. So, Backus's monograph offers strong evidence that Beza's Greek New Testament served as the primary original language source for the revision of the 1602 Bishop's Bible into what would ultimately become the King James Bible. Now, Sylvia, I think we need to note here that this was for the New Testament. So Beza's Greek New Testament would only influence changes made in the New Testament. Okay? The notes of Boyce highlight the immense influence of Beza upon the King James translators. So I propose the sources used to create the King James are as follows. Okay? I think the 1602 bishops, is clearly the base text. That's what Rule 1 says. And do we have Manuscript 98 and Bot 1602 that work in conjunction with a 1602 bishops and a 1611 King James to show you that that's the case? Okay? So 1602 bishops is the base text. So we're only talking right now about the New Testament. This 1602 bishops is compared against Beza's 1598 Greek New Testament most often. So remember what Rule 1 said. Rule 1 said, and I'm paraphrasing, Rule 1 said to follow the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original said what? Said otherwise. When they're looking and comparing the bishops to the original, the one most often that they use is Beza's 1598. It was the most recent Greek New Testament. It was the one that they would have been the most familiar with, and they would have viewed it as the most recent scholarship in Greek at that time. So as they revise the bishops and they're comparing it to the original for the New Testament, I think they're comparing it to Beza's 1598 most often. From there, they look at other earlier English Bibles. This would be Rule 14, I think. So this would be Tyndale, the Great Bible, Geneva Bible, Reims, etc. They would be looking at earlier English Bibles. Then I think they would look next at foreign language Bibles. Remember we saw earlier in the lesson, they looked at the French, they looked at the Italian and the Dutch, etc. And Dutch probably means German, by the way, not Dutch.
Deutsch.
Deutsch would be the way that. So that'd be like Luther's, etc. Okay. And then finally, extra biblical language resources. So I think there's a clear progression, and I'm doing this way so that folks on the video can see it. So rule one said to follow the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original said otherwise. What Boyce's notes and Backus's monograph demonstrate is how heavily Theodore Beza was looked to as a resource. So when they're comparing the 1602 bishops against the original, I think they are most often using Beza. I'm not saying they're only using Beza. I did not say they're only using Beza. I'm saying they're most often using who? Beza. Then they look at earlier English Bibles that are called for in Rule 14. Could somebody grab, there's a piece of paper in the back there that has the 14 rules on it. Can somebody grab that quick and bring it to me? I should probably be saying this more specifically than I am. There used to be a paper back there.
I've got it here.
Thanks. I'm referring to rule number, yes, 14. So rule number one says, the ordinary Bible to be read in the church, commonly called the bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. So as they look at this, they're comparing it, their most frequently used English or Greek language source is the 1598 Beza. Then rule 14, these translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the bishops, Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, White Church's, Geneva. So then they're looking thirdly, so they start with this, they look first at Beza, then they look at earlier English Bibles, then they look at foreign language Bibles, how do those read, then they look at extra-biblical language resources. Now, I cannot prove that as a definitive, they did this, then they did this, then they did this, then they did this. This is a general outline of what I think they did. They start with this, they clearly use Beza more than any other Greek source from what I can gather. Then they're comparing that, Beza and this, with earlier English Bibles. They're looking at foreign language Bibles, and then they're looking at other extant evidence of any kind that might impact how they think something should read. So I think from this, and from understanding Boyce's notes, and from seeing them in a sort of a greater, fuller context, we get the following takeaways. Number one, did the translators look at and utilize anything that was available to them that they thought would help them? Is there appear to be a prioritization in how they're working through information? Okay? So I think this gives us insights into their level of scholarship, the depth that they went into, and what were some of the most significant influences upon them in their thinking as they went through this. Okay? So I think that as they go to revise the bishops, the most impactful thing they had as far as original language for the New Testament was Beza. Now again, hear me. I'm not saying, somebody's going to write me on the internet and say, well, they used more than Beza. I get it. I'm not saying they only use Beza. I'm saying they use Beza the most often. You follow me? All right. Anybody got any comments or questions about this? Look, folks, I understand. Like, we're into it. We're into it at a level where some people are like, why are you even wasting your time with this? And I literally have had some people write me emails saying, you know, when are you going to pull the carpet out from everybody and reveal that you're really a modern version guy? And I'm like, have you been listening to all of this? Because that's not at all what the motivation of this has been from the beginning. But, you know, I've gotten an email like that in the last week. What I want is for advocates of the King James to know their stuff about where it came from and why it's important to the extent that it's known. I'm waiting. I cannot wait for Nicholas Hardy to publish his book or essay on Boyce's handwritten notes in this LXX. I want to read what he says about that. I want to know what he said. Now, I don't think that's necessarily going to change the overall picture for what I'm presenting here, but it would certainly have a lot of good tidbits in it. Any questions or comments?
Was Beza still alive during this conference? Or how?
That is a great question that I don't know the answer to off the top of my head. What year did Beza die? I don't know.
And was he doing his work through the Catholic Church?
No.
Oh, so he was a...
Beza was the successor to John Calvin at Geneva, Switzerland. Okay? He is viewed as, at the time, the eminent textual scholar of his day, which is why he is so influential over the King James translators. Even though a lot of them probably would not have agreed with Beza in his theology. Because obviously, as a successor of Calvin, he's very Calvinistic.
Brian?
Yeah.
Beza died in 1605.
1605, so he was dead. He died shortly after the project commenced, but he was dead for a while when they met at the Committee of Final Review. So, thanks for looking that up. Anybody else with a question? Okay, so next Sunday, we're going to go a little bit further with this. And then the Sunday following, then the last two Sundays of October, one of them is going to be the Bible conference on the 23rd, so we won't have this class that Sunday. And the last Sunday of the month, which is the 30th, Blake is supposed to teach class. So we're going to get tomorrow, next Sunday and one following, so two more, and then we'll get back to this in November. Okay? And let me just say, this, me being able to sort of have some time to play with here is helping me a lot, because otherwise, you know, it takes me a long time to put all these notes together. So it's not a quick process. I have to read all the material, I have to sort through it, I have to figure out what it's saying, and then I have to try to put it together in a way that makes sense to present it. Okay? But I'm doing this also, guys, with the view of eventually having all this in print, in a book, with these notes published in a book for people to be able to have access to them in that format as well. All right, if there's no questions, appreciate your attention.